How do you go from Silicon Valley to Hollywood? Welcome to Venture Voice, episode number 34. I'm your host, Greg Gallant. Today we're having David O. Sachs on the show. If you do business online or like movies, you've likely seen or used something that David was instrumental in creating. David co-founded PayPal with some of his friends from college after a stint as a management consultant at McKinsey. Under David's leadership, they fended off eBay as a competitor, took the company public, and eventually sold the company to eBay for $1.5 billion. Now, we talked to David today about what it's like to be in an environment of such rapid growth, but growing a business in a few short years to $1 billion and selling it poses its own problem. What do you do next? David moved to LA and set up a production company called Room 9 Entertainment. Now, moving to LA after making a lot of money, we know everyone wants to be a producer, but David really delivers. He just launched his first movie called Thank You for Smoking. The movie takes aim at political correctness. Its protagonist, Nick Naylor, is the chief spokesman for the tobacco industry. Here's a quick clip of the film's main character, Nick Naylor, introducing the movie from the trailer.
I don't have an MD or law degree. I have a bachelor's in kicking butt and taking names. I get paid to talk.
What do you talk about?
I speak on behalf of cigarettes.
My mommy says cigarettes kill.
Now, is your mommy a doctor?
No.
Well, she doesn't exactly sound like a credible expert now, does she?
Yeah. We call ourselves the Mod Squad. M.O.D. Merchants of Death. We're lobbyists for the tobacco, alcohol, and firearms industries.
How many alcohol-related deaths a year?
Well, 100,000.
That's what, 270 a day?
A tragedy. I front an organization that kills 1,200 people a day.
Dad, I want to see what you do.
The message Hollywood needs to send out is smoking is cool. You can put the sex back into cigarettes.
Get a flight to L.A. I'll get you a meeting with Hollywood super agent Jeff McGaw.
Yeah, I'm going to bring your dad in now. Is there anything I can get you, like an orange juice or a coffee or a Red Bull?
No, thanks.
Okay.
But what we need is a smoking role model, a real winner.
Indiana Jones meets Jerry Maguire.
Right, on two packs a day.
This movie isn't pro-smoking, but it goes after everyone. Politicians, journalists, business people, but most of all, it goes after spin. I'll play a few more clips from the movie at the end. But for now, let's hear about David's career, how it shaped his views, and why he wanted to make this movie. David, welcome to Venture Voice.
Thanks for having me.
I'm really interested in what you did as an undergraduate at Stanford. Typically, people who go on to have very successful careers in technology, you imagine being totally obsessed with technology and business at college. It sounds as though your interests were a little more wide-ranging.
Well, I graduated from Stanford in 1994, which was the year before the Netscape IPO, which kind of triggered the whole first wave of internet companies, and I kind of missed it. And I went to work in Washington for a year for a congressman who's actually now the head of the SEC, and I was interested in politics in those days in particular. And so I did it for a year, and then I went to law school, which is the default path for people who are smart but don't really know what to do with their lives. And so when I graduated from law school in 98, you know, I thought I kind of almost missed the whole internet boom. You know, all my friends who had gone to Stanford and graduated in, you know, 94, 95, 96, and ended up doing it, you know, had gone to work for companies like Yahoo and eBay. And I thought that was sort of, I thought I had missed it. And in 1999, I started talking to friends of mine who actually were creating a new startup, which became PayPal. And I kind of got into it kind of late in the game, but landed up coming back to Palo Alto in 1999.
So what was that experience like when you came back to Palo Alto?
Well, I came back in the sort of second half of 1999, and that was the peak of the whole frenzy. You know, this was right before the whole crash. You know, the internet market crashed around March, April of 2000, and so this was about 6 to 8 months before that, and it was really a very unique time. You could just feel the energy and, you know, the buzz, like, you know, in Palo Alto and San Francisco and in the whole all Silicon Valley. You know, when I was in school there, Palo Alto was a pretty boring sort of yuppie town, and Stanford was, you know, it was a pretty quiet campus, but you really felt a tremendous sense of energy there in 99. And, you know, people were starting companies left and right, and, you know, they were every night of the week there's a launch party for a different company. And, you know, I remember going to one launch party with some friends, and, you know, we were with a guy who, you know, had an idea for a company, and he went running around and came back just half an hour later and said, you know, I found the CTO that I'm going to start this company with. And then they went off together, and half an hour later they came back and said, okay, we found the VC who's going to finance the company, you know, and like, you know, half an hour later they come back and, you know, say, well, we found the first five employees of the company. You know, it's that's the kind of stuff that was happening. You know, you go to a party in one night and an entire company get founded. And there was just this whole sense of this crazy money-soaked carnival frenzy, you know, in the air. And and about 6 months later, it all crashed. And then the environment changed quite a bit.
So when you walked into it, what was the environment like when your friends approached you, and what was their pitch to you to convince you to jump into this lifestyle, having been trained as a lawyer and worked in Washington?
Well, you know, I guess I should add a couple of steps in my career. You know, when I graduated from law school in 98, I went to go work at McKinsey as a management consultant. I had already decided I didn't want to do law, I wanted to do business. And so for me, I didn't have to make a jump from law to business. I'd already done that. The question was sort of what I wanted to do, what business to go into. And the way I got involved in PayPal was the CEO, Peter Thiel, who was a good friend of mine from Stanford, called me up to tell me what he was doing there. And at the time, the idea of the company was to allow Palm users to beam money from one handheld device to another. And that was the idea of the company. And I told Peter, you know, who would want to do this? Why would they want to do it? You know, this seems like a really dumb idea to me, frankly. And in fact, I think PayPal or Confinity, the father company, was voted the worst VC-backed idea of that year. And Peter sort of agreed with me that there might be a very limited market for this. And so we started discussing ways that we could broaden that. You know, the idea that we kind of discussed was, well, beaming money might have a very limited appeal, but what happens if you get email money? That seems like a killer idea. And I said to Peter, well, you know, if the company does that, I'll quit my job tomorrow and go work to make that a reality. Because that was an idea that seemed like it had a lot of potential. And so that's basically what happened is Peter said, you know, I agree as well. And I left McKinsey and I joined. And essentially what I focused on was transforming the company from a mobile payments company to a web-based payments company.
So your role was primarily being the business person in the team?
Well, I originally came on board being the vice president of strategy, which was a license to interfere in any part of the company that I wanted to, essentially. But what I gravitated towards almost immediately was the product, because I realized that if you didn't have a good product, you didn't have anything. I mean, there are all these companies out there which are running around making lots of business deals. And the problem with that is you can make deals all day long, but if you don't have a great product that attracts users and does something that they want to do, it's all pretty much irrelevant. And so what I really started focusing my time on was figuring out how to make PayPal a really simple, intuitive, easy-to-use application for people who wanted to send money online. And I didn't really have a background in product management before. I just sort of picked up what I need to know on the job. And I landed up building PayPal's product management team and product design teams. And as the company grew, and we need to create a sales team to sell the product, a marketing team to market the product, and a customer service operation to service the product, the question was, well, who should be the one to build these teams up and manage them? And the logical choice was the person who had sort of developed the product or been most instrumental in developing the product. And so I landed up starting off focusing on the product, but it landed up leading me to become the chief operating officer of the company, being responsible for, you know, all the company's major functions.
So what did you find really worked for PayPal? Like, you know, were there any kind of key functionalities? I'm sure other people were thinking about this. What do you think were some of these key functionalities that really shot up past, you know, eventually BillPoint and all the other people out there going after this area?
You know, before PayPal, there had been a number of experiments in online payments companies. There were things like Flues and Beans, which were these online payments companies which were trying to create an alternative online currency. They weren't based on dollars. Then there were dollar-based systems.
Beans was Whoopi Goldberg's thing, right?
I think so. I mean, these companies were like really sort of famous in their time, but have all sort of become extinct now. there were companies like CyberCash and DigiCash, which were creating dollar-based systems, but they required you to download software onto your computer, sort of like client-based, and it was just very complicated. And I think from the outset, what was different about PayPal, and I know it seems really obvious, it's just that we decided we're going to be based on dollars. We weren't going to try to create a new currency. We thought dollars worked really well. And we're going to make it really simple and intuitive to use. So there'd be nothing you had to download on your end. And all you needed to do to pay somebody was enter their email address and your credit card or bank account so you had a payment source. And it was really just our dedication to making the product as simple and easy to use as possible that I think, you know, I think that was sort of where it started. And what I think the next significant step after just getting the product to work was it really took off on eBay as a way for people to pay for transactions on eBay. And that's when it really kind of blew up.
And that sounds like one of these situations where it must have created a lot of tension between you and eBay, that here you are getting huge off of their backs with what is, I guess, kind of a key functionality to their system working. How did you deal with that relationship with dealing with eBay on that?
Well, I guess it's one of these situations which, I guess you use the word cooperative. Well, it's sort of cross between competition and cooperation. I guess it's like co-optition or something like that. The reason why it was fundamentally very beneficial to eBay is that before PayPal, the way people were buying things on eBay is they'd win the auction, and then they'd have to mail a check. The buyer would have to mail a check to the seller, and the seller would have to wait for the check to receive in the mail. They would then deposit the check, have to wait for it to clear in their bank account to make sure it didn't bounce, and then they'd mail the item. And so you would have essentially a two-week process, frequently, for the buyer and the seller to complete their transaction. And what PayPal did is allowed the buyer and seller to pay immediately. You know, the buyer would win the auction. They would then go the seller would provide the buyer with their email address. And all the buyer had to do is go on PayPal and then email the money to the seller. And so it essentially compressed the amount of time that it took for a buyer to complete the transaction from 2 weeks to, you know, a minute. And that tremendously accelerated the volume of commerce on eBay and was very beneficial to them. At the same time, I think eBay probably felt like they didn't own their own cash registers, and it was a very sort of bizarre situation for them where, you know, the checkout line was on a different website, and they felt like, for strategic reasons, they had to own their own checkout line. And so they introduced a product called BillPoint, which was their competitive offering. And for about 2 years, PayPal and BillPoint competed head-on, and eBay users stuck with PayPal and wanted to keep using PayPal, even though eBay found ways to more deeply integrate BillPoint into their website. And I think that was a sort of a period of very intense competition between the two companies, which ultimately was resolved when eBay acquired PayPal.
Now, what was that like for you being in, I mean, it's enough to be in an extremely fast growth environment where you're building this huge infrastructure out of nothing at a level that you'd probably never managed it before. But in addition to that, having to compete with one of the, you know, biggest success stories in internet history.
It was very intense. And there were a number of times where we thought the company might die. And I think, in fact, you know, might have. It was really a roller coaster. I mean, just to give you some of the milestones. At the end of 1999, we had a few thousand users of the website, which we had basically gotten through direct mail and getting our friends to use it. That was about the time it started to take off on eBay. And so by the end of January of 2000, 1 month later, we went from having about 10,000 users to 100,000 users. By April, we had about 1 million users. And by the end of the summer of 2000, we had about 5 million users. Which was, it's the fastest growing financial service, I think, ever in history. And we went from having three people doing customer service to, we built a customer service center in Omaha, Nebraska. We went to a Holiday Inn there, and over a 48-hour period, we hired about 100 customer service representatives. And then, you know, that just kept scaling and scaling. I think now PayPal is one of the largest employers in Omaha with, you know, literally thousands of customer service representatives there. So, you know, you had this intense period where we were scaling up the company very, very quickly. We were also burning a lot of money. You know, originally PayPal was free. We weren't charging anything. And we had to develop a business model, and that business model was charging transaction fees to sellers, essentially the recipients of the payments. And at that point, almost everything on the internet was free. There wasn't that much that was being charged fees for. and very few websites had successfully migrated a sort of free user base to a fee-paying user base. And that was a huge challenge that we had to do. And at the same time we had to do that, we had to compete with eBay's new service, which they were actually giving away for a period of time. So it was a very, very intense period where we were scaling up the company like crazy, burning a lot of money, trying to develop a business model, trying to upgrade our customers to fee-paying customers without alienating them, and then competing with eBay at the same time. So yeah, it was very intense.
So what's the trick to doing that without exploding?
I think there was a great willingness on the part of the management team to always confront the problems that the company was facing head on. And so we really believed in Andy Grove saying, you know, only the paranoid survive. And I think we were really paranoid about the company's problems, which in this case caused us just to think every day about, you know, what are the company's big problems, how do we solve those? And it was just every day it was a process of trying to reduce risk, trying to execute. And I think we just stayed really focused on executing. If something wasn't working, we weren't afraid to acknowledge that it wasn't working, and we would change what we were doing. And I think that a lot of our competitors, you know, we were competing not just against eBay, we were also competing against Citigroup and Bank of America and Wells Fargo and Western Union, essentially all the banks and all the major banks and the sort of legacy payments infrastructure. Once PayPal started being successful, decided they had to compete with us as well, and so they would launch a website, but that website would never change. And I think that, you know, what we learned is anytime our competitors launched a feature that was better than us, we weren't afraid to acknowledge that, and we would essentially imitate it and get better. And we kept innovating and improving our site. And, you know, most of our competitor sites just didn't innovate, and they didn't change, and they weren't flexible. And we were just very flexible.
How were you affected in all this? I mean, you'd lived other lives in law school, in McKinsey. Were you just loving this more than anything else, or were you afraid, or what was your feeling throughout all this?
Well, I think it was a great experience overall. I mean, it really was, you know, it was a very intense experience, you know, but I was, you know, I was working with a great team of people. I thought, you know, I thought all the officers of the company was like a uniquely, I think, talented, smart team, and really all the way through the company, you know, I had a great team of people working in the product group and, you know, helping to build the product and throughout the whole company, really. So, you know, it was actually like a really wonderful, creative, you know, intense experience. And, you know, emotionally while you're doing it, it was a little bit of a roller coaster because some days you're, you know, it looks like the company's going to be huge, and the next day it looks like, you know, you've got some huge competitive problem. And so, you know, a lot of ups and downs while you're actually doing that sort of thing. But, you know, in retrospect, you know, certainly it was just an incredible, unique, sort of one-of-a-kind type experience to build a company that big in such a short amount of time.
Sounds that way. And tell me about the exit. What happened when, you know, I guess you guys finally pretty much beat out eBay and they came knocking?
Right. Well, we had been sort of fighting with eBay for about 2 years. And, you know, I think that at a certain point, we felt like the merger made sense. You know, they came to us and we had already gone public. In the spring of 2002, we had our IPO. If you think about it, we had gone from launching a product at the end of 1999 to the internet crash in, you know, April of 2000 till 2 years later, IPOing the company, which sort of gave you a sense of how quickly things had moved. But, you know, we always felt like there were a tremendous number of risks inherent in the company. You know, one was that even though we had successfully outcompeted eBay for 2 years, you know, it wasn't clear to us that that would always be the case just because they owned the platform. I mean, they owned the store. We owned the checkout registers, but they owned the store, and it was just, you know, that was a huge risk for us. There were a lot of other risks or regulatory risks, and, you know, we had taken the company public in the spring, and then they came to us with an acquisition offer that we felt made sense. So, you know, we ended up selling the company to them for about $1.5 billion in eBay stock.
That's a good exit, and I guess in retrospect, we'll never know if PayPal would have made it as a solo company, but you ever think, hey, we could still be in this game, we could still be making it? Or do you think that this was, you know, even in retrospect, clearly a great deal?
Well, you know, you never know the answer to those types of things. I mean, PayPal as a division of eBay has been incredibly successful. I mean, they've got over 100 million users all around the world. They did over $1 billion in revenue last year. You know, their payment volume is now in excess of, you know, something like $2 or $3 billion a month. You know, so the PayPal economy is enormous. And so there's no question that if PayPal had those kinds of numbers as a standalone company, it would now be worth, you know, could easily be worth $10 billion or more today. So, you know, that's the one hand. On the other hand, you know, PayPal's business was accelerated tremendously by its integration deeply into eBay. And so, you know, when PayPal was competing with eBay, we would have to essentially persuade sellers to persuade their buyers to go to the PayPal website or click on a PayPal logo in the auction to make the payment. And I think, you know, at our peak, as a standalone company on eBay, we had about 50% of eBay transactions were being processed by PayPal. I think that's now more than, well, that now basically is close to 100%. It's well over 90% of eBay transactions are now cleared through PayPal. And so that's essentially allowed PayPal just to double its eBay volume. And then, of course, the eBay platform has been growing, and, you know, it's allowed PayPal's off-eBay volume to grow as well. So, you know, I don't know that PayPal could have achieved the level of performance that it has today without being part of eBay. And so, you know, I think on a certain level, there were tremendous merger synergies, and the deal just made a lot of sense. Maybe the one thing we should have done was negotiate a bigger earnout or something like that. But I think that, you know, in terms of the merger synergies, the deal certainly made a tremendous amount of sense.
Well, definitely sounds like, I mean, it's clearly proven out to be a huge win. What did it look like for you personally at that time? I mean, how much of the company did you own? You know, what kind of stratosphere did that put you in at the time of exit?
You know, I think I did reasonably well. I sort of got what CEOs usually get, I think. I don't really talk about exact numbers, but, you know, I did reasonably well, and, you know, it gave me the flexibility to kind of do whatever I wanted to do next. So, that, I mean, that was sort of the main thing.
What was your ambition going into all this? I mean, did you just want to make a bunch of money and now you've done that? Did you have a lot of aspirations up until that point?
Well, I think, honestly, if it's just about the money, I think the people who are just in it for the money don't end up building great companies. I think there has to be a higher level of ambition to really create something that can change the world. And I think that was common to all of the key people involved at PayPal, was that there was a tremendous desire to do something really revolutionary that could truly change the world. And in PayPal's case, the ambition was to create a payment system that would allow any two people in the world to transfer money to each other pretty much without any friction whatsoever. And that was sort of the ambition. And I think that kind of ambition does characterize all the great internet companies. If you look at Google, you know, their ambition wasn't just to create sort of an advertising channel for small businesses. Their ambition is to take all the information in the world and organize it into a way that people can access it. And so I think that when you look at the great internet companies, they all have some sort of macro goal which goes beyond just people trying to make money. And I think that was true in this case. I think it's true with all of them.
Now, I read an interview with your co-founder, Max Levchin, who was talking about after the eBay sale that he was depressed, that he kind of felt like he could never top this amazing success that you guys had with PayPal. Did you have that same feeling?
Well, you know, I would say that the sale of your company is sort of always bittersweet, in the sense that, I mean, obviously you wouldn't sell if you didn't think that was the right thing to do. At the same time, I think we felt like we had created a very unique culture at PayPal. It was extremely entrepreneurial. You know, it was very lean. It was a very lean organization. It felt like people got a lot of responsibility very early on. If you were good in the organization, you get promoted very quickly. You know, it felt like it wasn't a traditional corporate culture. And I think that what was sort of sad about it is, you know, when you sell your company and it gets acquired by a larger company, it's only a matter of time before that larger company's culture takes over. And so I think on that level, it was kind of bittersweet. You know, in my case, I had something else I wanted to do, which was, I didn't have this necessarily in mind when I was selling the company, but, you know, once we sold it and I was thinking what else I wanted to do next, I was very interested in the entertainment business and making movies. And so, you know, Max is a technologist, and, you know, for him, the question was, well, what new technology do I want to create next? And for me, it was more, I'm more of a product guy, and so the question was, what kind of product do I want to create? And I decided to kind of make a clean break with Silicon Valley and go to L.A. and make movies. And so I just made this movie, Thank You for Smoking, which is out in theaters right now, which has been quite successful. And so I think for me personally, psychologically, it was easier to move on because I just decided I want to do something completely different.
That sounds very exciting. Did you feel like there was a risk? I mean, you had the perfect, you know, Silicon Valley resume at this point, taking a company public. They're very kind of cushy jobs as venture capitalist where, you know, you're in the power seat. You know, what was it like to just say, okay, I'm going to drive down to LA and just, you know, get into a totally new world?
Well, you know, it did involve certainly a lot of risk. I mean, the movie business is notorious for taking money from outside equity and people who come from outside the business and come to Hollywood thinking they can do better. You know, you look at all the movies in theaters and most of them are pretty bad and you feel like you can do better than most. And, you know, Hollywood's very notorious for taking those people's money and then emptying out their pockets and sending them on their way. And so, you know, I was very cognizant of that going in, and I was very sort of patient and cautious in my approach towards it. I wanted to learn how to do it myself. I didn't really want to rely too much on Hollywood insiders. And that was sort of my approach going in. And so it was very risky, but my goal was just to make a movie that I really believed in personally, and I feel like that's what I did.
So when you got to LA, what was step number one to getting into the movie business?
Well, we set up a company, and then the next step was just to start looking for scripts. And we must have looked at, this company has read over 1,500 different scripts. And, you know, thank God I haven't had to read all of them myself. I've, you know, had help, but there's a few other people in the company. But that's basically what we did, is we started looking for scripts. And one of the early scripts that we found that I really loved was this project, Thank You for Smoking. And it was written by a young filmmaker, sort of his passion project based on a book by Christopher Buckley. And Jason Reitman was sort of the young writer-director. He never directed a feature before, but he had directed several shorts. And I loved it. I didn't understand why it had never been made. I originally read it as a writing sample for Jason. And the reason why it never got made is because it had spent about 10 years in Hollywood development hell. Basically, at a major studio had developed it and spent over $1 million on the project. And Hollywood has these rules that if you want to make a movie, which somebody else owns the rights to, typically they expect you to buy them out completely in order for you to take over the project. And so we spent about 18 months negotiating the rights to get the rights to the project. And when that finally happened, we actually moved really quickly. That was probably the most difficult part of the whole process for me as the producer, was just getting the rights to Jason's script and the underlying book. And once we did that, we were actually in production shooting the movie within 6 months.
Great. You must have been really impatient. I mean, at PayPal, it sounds like an 18 months, you know, was a huge amount of time to spend 18 months.
It's one of the big differences between the entertainment business and the technology business, is that the entertainment business tends to move very slowly, and technology business obviously moves extremely quickly. And it can be quite frustrating, absolutely. But, you know, once we actually did get the rights, we did move very quickly. We cast the movie within 3 months. We did pre-production where we found all the locations and did scouting in Los Angeles and Washington, D.C. We did that in 2 months. Then we actually shot the movie in about 8 weeks. It was under, you know, about 2 months. And then the editing actually is another place where it tends to slow down a little bit. We spent about 5 or 6 months doing all the post-production where you do all the editing and you do all the music on the movie. And then we took the movie to the Toronto Film Festival in September of 2005, and we had a bidding contest, and Fox Searchlight won the bidding war, and we sold the movie to Fox Searchlight. And then they released the movie in March of 2005, so about 6 months later. And we had the whole sort of marketing PR campaign, and now the movie's still out in theaters. We're actually about to enter our 9th week being in theaters.
What was your role like as producer? I'd imagine a lot of people might assume that you were hands-off, but I heard that you were quite involved as a producer with the show.
Well, you know, it's sort of similar to what I did at PayPal in a certain sense, which is, you know, PayPal is responsible for the product, and my job was to bring together the team of people who would create the product. And that's very similar to what you do as a producer, is it's your job to bring all the pieces together. And so you bring the rights together, and, you know, you hire the director, which in this case was very easy because we wanted to hire the guy who wrote the script, Jason Reitman. And then, you know, you work with the director, hire the rest of the crew, and you got to put together the financing deals. And in this case, we had a foreign sales partner called Content Film, which pre-sold a number of foreign territories. And so we had financing deals we had to work out. We had union deals we had to work out. So it's like, it's this very complicated product with lots of moving pieces. And the producer's job essentially is to make all those pieces work together in harmony, and that's sort of what I did.
Now tell me about what drove you with this movie. I saw it, I thought it was great, and I thought was interesting that Nick Naylor, played by Aaron Eckhart's the hero of the movie, with this kind of cynical slant, but here he's the hero, and Heather Holloway, played by Katie Holmes, playing the reporter, is the villain, and the senator, played by William H. Macy, is kind of an opportunist, not someone you'd look up to. What attracts you to this kind of to this view, to this kind of angle?
Well, it felt very fresh to me. I love the inversion of the conventional morality that you get in most movies, where you take your typical movie about smoking, and take for instance The Insider, which actually I thought was a terrific movie. But in most movies about the subject matter, you would expect that the chief spokesman for Big Tobacco, who's played by Aaron Eckhart, would be the villain. And here he's the hero, and you're on his side and you're rooting for him. I think it's one of the amazing things that Jason sort of accomplishes, that he really gets you on Nick Naylor's side, even though he has this sort of dastardly job where he's got a spin on behalf of cigarettes. You understand why he's doing it, and you actually kind of go with it. Whereas the people who are usually heroes in this kind of movie, you've got the intrepid reporter and the crusading senator, they're actually the villains, and they're kind of exposed as hypocrites in this movie. And, I like that. It felt very fresh to me. And, this is a movie about political correctness, and I love the fact that it wasn't conforming to the typical conventions about what a movie about cigarettes was supposed to be saying.
So it sounds like the novelty and the freshness attracted you, but it's more than that. It's that you kind of want to expose some of these things in society today.
Well, I think that Nick Naylor, who's the hero of the movie, is a spin doctor, and we can all sort of denounce the use of spin in our society, but the question is, why do we have it? Why do we need spin? And I think it's because spin is a way of protecting us from political correctness. That I think there's a sense that if you speak the truth about certain issues, you're going to be denounced or you could be sued. We live in a tremendously litigious society, and spin becomes this buffer. It's like this necessary buffer that we use to protect ourselves. And so I think the hypocrisy in the case of cigarettes is that, or any of vices, is that, on some level, people want their vices. They want cigarettes, or they want to be able to drink, or to engage in any number of things which aren't good for you. But then when you actually get sick because of these products, you want, in theory, someone else to pay for it. And I mean, that's the fundamental hypocrisy, basically, is that we want these vices, but we're not willing to take responsibility for them. And I think Thank You for Smoking is a movie about responsibility and the need to take responsibility. If we want to have personal freedoms, then we need to have a sense of responsibility that comes along with that.
When did you get excited about these ideas? Was it the movie that got you excited, or was it something out of your career? I know you'd been involved with some lawsuits with your time at PayPal. Was there something in your career that really got you excited about these ideas, or at least passionate about them?
I think the common denominator between the movie and the other things I've sort of done in my career is there probably is a somewhat libertarian bent to them. The movie does have this somewhat libertarian message to it. I think PayPal had a somewhat libertarian theme to it as well, where we were trying to allow people anywhere in the world to pay each other without, the need for central authorities or interference from governments and that sort of thing. There are a lot of governments in the world which try to restrict their currency. And, one of the things animating PayPal was our thought that we can just make the world freer by creating, a frictionless monetary system. And so I think there was that common denominator. And then when I was at Stanford, I was involved in student journalism on the Stanford Review, and we certainly had an anti-political correctness theme there where, we were against the speech code. We wanted Stanford to be a much more free sort of community of ideas where you didn't have speech codes restricting what people could say. And so I think there is somewhat of a theme running through the various things that I've worked on.
How do you think that's changed in society in the past 10 years? Do you think we've gotten more PC and on campuses too, more PC or less PC?
I think things have gotten a lot better is my guess. When I was at Stanford, it was just shortly after the time where students were marching and yelling, "Hey, hey, ho, ho, Western culture's got to go." And I think that I don't think anyone would be marching saying that today, at least not in the West. You might hear that cheer, at a protest staged by the government in Tehran or something like that, but you're quite unlikely to hear it, I think, on an American college campus today. So I think in that sense, things have gotten quite a lot better.
Now, did you find that when you were in PayPal, too, did you find yourself having to spin, not being able to say the truth because you had to kind of conform to what people were looking for?
No, not really. I mean, I think that, you know, like I said, I think we created a company culture where, you know, we really felt like it was pretty free, and the object was to let people speak the truth and speak their minds, and there's no penalty for disagreeing with the people who were above you in the organization. And we really tried to make it, you know, very open and free, and, you know, maybe we didn't always succeed, but I think that most people probably felt it was that way, especially compared to more corporate company cultures. I do think it was a very open, sort of free place to work.
So with your current company now, Room 9 Entertainment, what's your ambition with this? Is it just to keep producing one movie at a time, or are you looking to grow this into something larger?
Well, I think the goal is just to keep making movies which are interesting to us personally. You know, we're not really interested in making lots of movies which we don't necessarily believe in, or just making a product as sort of a piece of business. The goal really is just to make movies that we personally ourselves would like to go out and see in a theater. As long as we can keep doing that, I think we're being successful. So that's sort of the goal there. At the same time, you know, we are going to look at some of the places where you're getting technology and media converging. So there's a lot of really interesting things going on right now on the web where you're getting sort of next generation media companies forming. You've got companies like, you know, MySpace and YouTube and companies like that, which are, you know, it's a user-generated web, and so we're going to look at whether it makes sense for us to make investments in some of those kinds of companies.
That's exciting, and that's something, I guess, so far, like, those companies are more technology platforms, and it seems as though the whole industry is kind of going through this confusion over whether something's a media company or a technology company. What's your view going into that, I guess, now, is being more of a content or a media company?
Well, you know, I guess the way people... The term that people use for these technologies is they call them disruptive technologies, which is you've got a traditional industry that's been marching along for 50 years, and all of a sudden somebody in another city outside the industry launches some technology, and in the course of a couple of years it completely reforms, reshapes, and destroys that industry. You take an example, for instance, there's this online site called Wikipedia, which is this user-generated encyclopedia. There's no centralized editorial staff. And in a very short amount of time, Wikipedia has become the dominant encyclopedia, I think, in the world and on the web, and it's completely eviscerated the economics of the encyclopedia business. That's one small example, I think, of how a new technology can just totally shake up an industry. And I think what's going to happen in the media business is over the next few years, and it might take 3 years, it might take 5 years or 10 years, but you're going to start seeing the web being used as a distribution platform for content, and it's not clear to me that the traditional distributors are going to be the ones who really build the best web product to do that. You're already seeing it in part with iTunes, has already become the dominant distribution platform for digitally downloaded music. It's really shaking up the music business. The music business has been in transition for a number of years, but iTunes now has become the platform for legal downloads. It's also getting into video downloads. And then you're seeing a whole new kind of market popping up with these video sites, which are allowing users to post their own videos.
So you think that this could eventually start making, whereas right now maybe that's affecting what people would have otherwise spent watching TV, this can start affecting the film business too?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's working on a few different levels. You know, one is that it's just enabling a whole different kind of content that never existed before. So this whole idea of user-generated videos, you know, how could they have ever gotten an audience before the internet? And so I think it's creating this whole different kind of content, which is a potential alternative for people's entertainment time. So they can, you know, watch TV, or they can watch movies, or they could get on the web and be entertained on the web. And I think on that level, it's very, you know, it could be quite competitive. But there's also the whole level on which the web could eventually provide a distribution channel, which allows content creators, not just of user-generated videos, but also people like me who are creating movies, to create a straight-to-consumer model. So you don't necessarily have to go through, you don't have to go through the Warner Brothers or the Foxes or the Sonys. You know, there's an oligopoly of only about half a dozen major distributors in Hollywood. They essentially have a stranglehold on distribution, and because of that, they capture most of the value of movies, even if they're not the ones who produce them. And the internet does provide a potential alternative to that.
I like what you said about these disruptive businesses often starting in cities different from the industries they disrupt or shrink. Do you think that the disruptive, you know, whatever is going to really make a big effect on the film industry? Is that going to happen in L.A., or do you predict that it's going to happen somewhere else in the country?
Well, it's hard to know. I mean, you know, if I had to bet on Silicon Valley versus Hollywood in terms of shaping the future of technology, or sorry, not technology, but of entertainment, I'd probably bet on Silicon Valley just because that's what it does. I mean, it's really good at innovation. Silicon Valley is this tremendous innovation machine. You've got people thinking outside the box. You know, a lot of cases are not really familiar with the way things are done in Hollywood, and that's frankly an advantage. And so, you know, I think what's going to happen is that you'll continue to see a tremendous amount of innovation coming out of Silicon Valley. I think over time, I think one thing I will say about the entertainment business and about Hollywood that's very positive is it's very porous and osmotic, and when it sees that other people are developing good ideas or it identifies some new type of talent, it does tend to be very open as a community in terms of bringing that in. So, you know, you could take a director like, you know, Jason Reitman, who made Thank You for Smoking. He makes one really good movie, and boom, you know, Hollywood may entrust him with the next big, you know, superhero movie if that's what he wants to do. And so Hollywood's always been very good about embracing new talent, and they've been less good about embracing new technology. So I think what's going to happen over time is the new technologies will be developed in Silicon Valley, and then slowly but surely the traditional companies in Hollywood will start to embrace those technologies, and you'll see a lot of, I think, M&A activity over the next few years.
So in terms of your role and kind of staying ahead of this and adding value and changing the industry, do you see yourself just as kind of the standard angel investor where you're going to fly back up to Silicon Valley and make a few investments, or do you think that, you know, you're going to be spending the one and kind of porting it over and leveraging that in Hollywood? How do you want to fit into this?
Well, you know, it could be sort of any of the above. I mean, what I would say is, you know, there aren't very many people who've actually done both successfully, both meaning an internet startup and a sort of movie startup. And so I think I understand both businesses pretty well. And yeah, I'm looking at essentially making angel type investments in companies. We're looking at doing that. You know, I think it would want to be something where I could actually help the companies. You know, I don't know if it makes sense for me just to make passive investments in companies. I think what makes sense is for me to make an investment and then actually really try and help the company get to the next stage. And so I'm looking at doing a number of those kinds of things.
Boy, well, that sounds like an exciting thing to be looking at business plans and movie scripts at the same time.
Well, in a sense, I mean, the common denominator is that you're kind of picking winners, right? You want to look for really good ideas. You want to look for good people. You want to look for good plans and good ideas. And I'm sort of very open to doing that in either business. So, you know, I love both technology. I love entertainment. And I've worked in both. And that's what I want to keep doing, is just finding really good people, really good ideas, really good projects in both to work with and support.
How do you know if someone's a winner? What's your what are some of the telltale signs you look for?
It's really just, you meet somebody and you either think they're really smart or they're not, they're really creative or they're not. And, you know, you never really know until you work with somebody closely, but, you know, I think it's just an instinct for hopefully picking good people to want to work with.
And it sounds like the interesting thing is between your roles, between how you make your investment decisions, it sounds like it hasn't changed terribly much between Silicon Valley and LA.
Well, you know, it's similar in the sense that, like I said, you want to work with the best people. I think you want to work with people who are under-recognized in some sense. So it wouldn't make any sense for me to go to Hollywood and try and get in business with Steven Spielberg, okay? That would just be a total waste of time. There's already tons of people who are working with Steven Spielberg, and his career is already, you know, he's a top guy in Hollywood. I think what makes a lot more sense is to find really young, smart, talented people who haven't quite been given that kind of shot yet. You know, whether it's, you know, Jason Reitman on our movie, who had never directed a feature film before, but had directed a number of shorts and TV commercials and had shown a lot of promise and talent. You know, I think making those kinds of opportunities come true for people makes a lot more sense. And I think that's where you're going to find opportunities that have been overlooked, is with, you know, younger, smarter, creative people who've got great ideas but haven't really been given a shot yet.
Great. So tell me what your next few steps are. What are you spending your time on right now?
You know, it's sort of like a mix of different things. You know, the company is moving towards development on our, moving towards production on our next movie. We've got a project that's a picture about Salvador Dali, who is this one of the most influential painters of the 20th century, and we have a really fun movie that's not just a biopic about him, but it's kind of got this "Catch Me If You Can" type caper element to it. And we're sort of wrapping up a director deal right now, and we hope to be shooting that in the next 6 months to a year at the latest. And so we're moving forward on that. We're continuing to look at new movie scripts, and so we're always looking for great scripts that we can develop and make into movies. And then on the technology side, I'm helping friends with their companies. I'm looking at getting involved in different companies and just being a consultant or advisor or board member to some companies where I can make a difference.
Great. Well, David, where we can't stop using PayPal, and I'm a big fan of the movies, so thanks a lot for coming on the show.
Thanks very much.
Well, you don't run into too many people who are interested in both investing in movies and technology. To give you a better feel for David's movie, I'm going to play another clip for you. You're about to hear Thank You for Smoking's protagonist, Nick Naylor, react to his son's homework assignment to write an essay about why America has the best government in the world.
BS, if I may, is what questions like the one your teacher posed are made for. Because even if America had the best government, there'd be no way to prove it. And how many pages are you writing?
2 pages.
2 pages. Definitely not 2 pages.
So what am I supposed to write?
You can write whatever you want.
Okay.
Write about America's amazing ability to make profit by breaking down trading tariffs and bringing American jobs to third world countries. Or how good we are at executing felons. They're all correct answers.
I can do that.
See, Joey, that's the beauty of argument. Because if you argue correctly, you're never wrong.
Obviously, one of the rewards of entrepreneurship is you can do what you want after you're very successful. Now let's just get one more clip from the movie.
We sell cigarettes, and they're cool and available and addictive. The job is almost done for us.
I usually tell you to come to our website, www.venturevoice.com, to view show notes where you can get links and quotes from things that we've talked about in this show, to leave comments on the show where you and other people can read it, and to get in touch with us privately. But now there's an additional incentive to come to our site. Be sure to view it. We're going to put up a photo of David Sacks like we do with all of our guests, but you can keep an eye out for him when you go see the movie. He cameos in it, and I'm not going to tell you where. You're going to have to figure this one out for yourself. Now, I've told you about logging on to our website, but you can also interact with us by coming to the Venture Voice Startup Workshop, June 26th, 2006, in New York City. If you come, you can interact with some of our past guests, ask them questions, and we're really going to be pushing the envelope here on entrepreneurship. We're going to be digging a lot deeper into everything that we've been talking about on the show, and we're going to give you insights at a whole new level. Hope to see you there. You can find more details at www.venturevoice.com/workshop or venturevoice.com and click on the link. Until next time, I'm Greg Gallant with Venture Voice, entertaining entrepreneurship.